This is a download from BFM 89.9. The Business Station.
Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn. I'm Lee Chui Lin. Many of us are armchair activists at best, but Dr. Mohamed Yunus Mohamed Yassin is a man who walks the talk. With a simple philosophy to not complain, get involved, and do what you can to make a change in our country, Dr. Yunus has been a driving force in mentoring and encouraging students to excel in science, especially in our local Tamil schools. He joins me now to discuss both the challenges and successes of this quiet science revolution, which is being driven through the work of the Association of Science, Technology and Innovation, or ASTI, which he is president of. Welcome to the show, Dr. Yunus.
Thank you, Lynn.
I understand that it was your late father who instilled in you the lesson to help those in need, you know, putting aside race and religion. How much has that shaped the work that you do?
Interestingly enough, my father was in radio as well.
Okay.
So he used to work in Radio Malaysia in Ipoh. Right. And he was actually one of the founding members of that particular radio station that he used to work for. And a lot of the things that he used to bring out in his shows and whatnot are mostly relevant current issues. And one of the current issues when he was working at the radio station, also as a DJ, he was also a presenter, was the issue of workers, plantation workers. So this was in the early 70s. There were a lot of plantations being moved about and all that, and a lot of these workers were left in the lurch. So this is something that he brought close to his heart because he saw that this, you know, people who have lived generations in a particular area and are suddenly asked to move out, and they don't really have anywhere to go. So this was one of the issues that he worked very hard on. And I remember that even as he grew older and I was born, I was actually born in Ipoh as well, he always told me about that story, and he said that we should always work and defend the downtrodden. So that's something that kept close to my heart from the very beginning.
And was that something that you had practiced in before, you know, you went abroad or before you started the work that you're doing now?
One of the things that my dad always used to say that before you can help others, you need to help yourself. So at the early stages, I was more concentrated on my studies, or at least trying to. I was actually slightly dyslexic, which I did not know. So I always did extremely badly at exams. In fact, only at Standard 4, I got the first mark, which was 2-digit. Normally, I'll get like 8%, 3% on my exams. So that's something that kind of had an effect on me as well, because I always thought that I was not very intelligent because the exams told me so. And then as time went on, as I entered university, there were a lot of movements, especially community-driven movements, you know, movements like teaching tuitions to secondary school students to get them into universities, career talks and all that kind of stuff. So I was involved in that, but not major, nothing drastic in that sense. So I used to help out here and there where I can. But where this, or at least this mindset of me trying to help others, came about more so when I was in UK. So I, after I finished my undergrad in University of Kebangsaan, I went on to England to continue my PhD. And that is when it was more like a culture shock. I was suddenly all alone, kind of thing. So that's when I started getting a lot more involved in community work and also in other works like lobbying and stuff like that. So that's where you could say the major turn happened when I was in England.
I found it really interesting, you know, when you said that you felt unintelligent because exams were telling you
yes.
that you were unintelligent. And I think that that is something that a lot of students experience. You know, you feel yourself being defined in your educational world by a number that's given to you after a test. In the work that you do now with students in our local Tamil schools, do you find this to still be a problem, that people get disheartened by what they see on exam scores?
Very much so, actually. In fact, the whole education system at the moment is centered around exams, or centered around being measured, so to speak. So you have to measure your intelligence. And that's something which I kind of find hard to accept, kind of thing, because it's not something that it's not something easy to measure a person's intelligence. How do you measure a person's way of thinking or a person's way of coming up with a solution, especially in the current world in which even in science If you go to the level of quantum mechanics, there's no real correct answer. There's always what they call the best answer. So in quantum mechanics, so everyone says science is an exact. Science is something which is exact. Not necessarily so, because when you go to the highest level, even at that level, the answer, there's only what is right and what is more right, right, so to speak. So how do you measure something like that? So that is something which I have an issue with in that sense. But I guess the system needs certain way of measurement. So we look at different ways of measuring, so to speak, because your result is determined on how you measure. This is something that a lot of people do not realize or do not want to accept, that the way in which you measure will determine your result. So I can measure a particular student in a certain way, and he or she will get an A, and I measure that person's ability in a different way, and he or she would get a D or maybe even fail. So now, although we always look at the result and all that, we never really question how we actually measure.
In the simplest of terms, it's looking at a glass and seeing if it's half full or half empty. Both are correct.
Yeah. You could say that, yeah.
Yep. You mentioned your work in England, and that was in Arbury. Could you tell me more about what you did there?
This was towards my final year. This was after you submit. You know, most PhD students, they call it permanent head damage. So once you have submitted the paper, the book, which caused so much head damage, you've got about 3 months just waiting for your viva, for your exam. So that's when a group of friends said, hey, let's do something. So we decided to go to a place, like a village. Actually, Cambridge itself is a village. And besides the village, there's a smaller village. You know? So we used to go there and said, and then we used to see all these kids running around and say, why don't we teach them science and math? Because we are supposedly good in science and math, or so we were told. Towards then, in the beginning, I was told that I was stupid in science and math. Later on, I was told that I was intelligent in science and math. So
different measurements.
Go figure. Right? In any case, so we decided that we will do this. So a group of us just got together and just went there and started teaching them science and mathematics and stuff like that. So we didn't take much of it. We whoever comes, we teach. Then after some time, I had my viva. I finished and then I left and went back home. Came back home to KL. And I went back to Cambridge. I used to go back quite often, but that one particular visit, which was about 3 years ago, or more like 7 years after I completed my PhD, I was told that that particular area outside of Cambridge used to be one of the worst performing districts in UK, in England. But it had become one of the best performing districts. And one of the reasons why they said that was, as time went on, I think this thing kind of caught on. So more and more students in their past time and when they're free and all that, they used to go and teach, tuition, so to speak, free tuition, so to speak. So they used to go to schools, they organize activities, they organize science fairs, they organize all kinds of things. And then they brought all the students in the surrounding area of Cambridge for their activities. And based on a study that they made, this actually made a difference. This is what made the results of that particular area went up. So that taught me a very important lesson. This was a lesson that I may not even have known when I first started this, or we started it. And we did not, it's something that just grew organically, is that you can make a difference. A small group of people, if they are committed enough, it can make a difference, and you can actually make a difference in somebody's life.
And that small group of people is now ASTI. How and when did you form this association?
Actually, that group is not ASTI. That group, that particular group in Cambridge, they were like from all over the world.
Right.
So we went back to our respective countries. But when I came back, that's something, when I was doing this, I found that this is something that I like doing, working with young people, teaching them things. And then I actually end up learning a lot of things from young people, because young people are actually, they've got a different way of looking at things. Right, so there's something which I really lacked. So I decided that I want to be more involved in teaching young people. So it just so happened that a friend of mine was working with an NGO, and then he's working with NGOs in deprived neighborhoods, outside rural communities, so to speak. But mostly focused on Tamil schools now, because they were one of the most deprived. And he told me that can we do something with them? So I said, okay, let me have a visit. Let me go and have a look at some of the schools. So I did go and visit a few schools, and I was actually quite shocked to see the condition. I mean, we visited places where the classrooms were leaking, or there were some schools which did not have a toilet, literally did not have a toilet, no? That kind of situation. So that's when I was more driven to say that maybe we can or we should try to help these kids out. So we came up with a program called the Young Scientific Explorer, which is hands-on. So this is where I said the measurement is different. You see, one is you read, and then you go for exam, you blurt out everything that you read, and you get an A. But the program that we designed was actually more hands-on. Because a lot of people do not like reading because they are forced to read for reasons. They are not taught to love reading, but then they are taught to not like reading, because whenever you force something, it becomes difficult. So what we decided was we'll do something hands-on. So we used to go to the school, and then we do simple experiments. We don't go into the theory, because once you get into F equals MA, E equals MC squared, they go like, big words, you know? So we try to not go into too much of the theory. Just do simple science, make it look magical, make it look to create that wonderment among young people, so they can start asking questions. They ask, hey, why did this happen? Hey, why did that happen? And that's the most important thing for young people. They need to continue asking questions, because naturally young people naturally like to ask questions. It is us, we say, don't ask too many questions. You know, like parents, if they ask too many questions, we say, don't ask too many questions. That's something that we like saying, which is we shouldn't. So this whole program was to inculcate this curiosity and for them to start asking that question. So we did that for 3 years. It did quite, it went quite well. So what we decided then was to grow the project, and we decided to start this science fair, or science fair for young children. And the difference between the Young Scientific Explorer is the volunteer will go to the school and do the experiment and explain a little bit and come back. Science fair is inverted. It's the other way around. So the students will do the experiment, will show it to us and explain to us the theory. Which now comes, the whole idea of learning becomes inverted. So it is not the teacher who teaches. It is the student who teaches, and then the teacher now becomes facilitator. So whatever she or he listens to, the teacher, will now either correct it or ask a different question. Maybe not even correct, the word correct. To correct, we not be the right word to use. So, for example, if I were to say that for every action, there's an equal or opposite reaction. That's the third law. So, let's say the person says something wrong. So you can say, hey, don't you think that Newton actually said this? Why don't you look this up? Or why don't you look up this Google, this thing? So instead of answering something wrong with a correction,
what a
facilitator does is suggest or ask another question, so that person. So, in other words, what the facilitator, aka teacher, what used to be known as a teacher, does is to facilitate the student to find the right answer. So, the whole idea of learning becomes something which is a path of discovery rather than something which is forced down your throat, so to speak.
I'm speaking today with Dr. Mohamed Yunus Mohamed Yassin, president of ASTI, or the Association of Science, Technology and Innovation. We're discussing changing attitudes towards science and mathematics in Malaysian Tamil schools. Up next, we find out how receptive were students and schools when you first approached them with this idea, as well as how it might be incorporated into a curriculum. You are listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9. Good afternoon. You are listening to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture. I'm Lee Chui Lin, and in the studio with me, Dr. Mohamed Yunus Mohamed Yassin, president of the Association of Science, Technology and Innovation, or ASTI. And we're talking about ASTI's work in terms of trying to change attitudes towards science and math in Malaysian Tamil schools. Earlier you talked about, you know, seeing some of these schools and saying that they were just in really poor condition, especially and not conducive to learning. Was there anything that interested you about working with Tamil school kids in particular?
Two reasons. Number one is because the resources available for Tamil schools at that time was pretty bad. So I thought it's better to work with some people who do not have access to the resources. That's number one. And number two is also opportunistic in that sense, because my friend was with the foundation that works mostly with the rural town schools, the estate schools, they call it. So since I was working in collaboration with them, so it kind of grew from there. So that's how it went about.
And when you first went about talking about these different projects that you have, the science, Young Scientific Explorer, the Science Fair for Young Children, were schools and the kids receptive to the idea? Were they welcoming? Or did they take some convincing?
Yeah, actually, they did need some convincing. But we were, in that sense, quite lucky because we started with what's called the Young Scientific Explorer, which is we just go into a classroom and we get 1 hour. We convince the HM to give us one period. So during that period, we'll do the experiments and get the students excited, and then we leave. And then, of course, we also do surveys. We survey the teacher, we survey the HM, we survey the students and all that. We come up with results. And then we share these results with the schools. So showing that, look, your look at our survey. Survey shows that students are learning better or they're having more fun and stuff like that. So it was more like we were building bridges, so to speak, between us and the school slowly. So this was after 3 years of this particular program. That's when we started Science Fair. So Science Fair is something that requires a lot more commitment from the school. Because the other one is they just need to give one period. We go in, we do the experiment, then we leave, and then they continue their studies. In this case, we will go in, we'll train the teachers, and then the teachers have to work with the students to come up with a project. And that's done over a three-month period. So the commitment is pretty big. But in that sense, we were lucky that we already built a good relationship with them. So when we actually came up with Science Fair and said, look, we've got this new program, which is much more extensive and your students can learn a lot more, they were more receptive. And I must say that some teachers were more receptive than others.
Okay.
But teachers who were very receptive. And that's why we always say that the success of this particular project is mostly due to the teachers' commitment. There's a lot of complaint about teachers saying that they are no longer as committed as they used to be and all that kind of stuff. But I would say that that's only partially true because there are still a lot of teachers out there who are extremely committed, but they do not have the opportunity or the platform in which they can express their commitment, so to speak. So in that sense, you could say that we are actually more a platform for teachers to use to express their commitment. Yeah.
And when we look at the science fair, I understand that you and your team built the program from scratch. Was this a considered decision to not just emulate an existing model or to take it and build upon it?
Yes. We wanted to make sure it is localized. We tried not to depend on consultants. For main reason, we were poor. We couldn't afford consultants. But even if we could, we wouldn't, so to speak. But we decided to work within our own means. So since I've got a PhD in chemical engineering, and then another person that got involved, he's got a PhD in chemistry. So we were all in the particular field that we were expressing or we were trying to push for. And then we also got teachers involved because one of the most important things is not just knowledge, but the ability to communicate knowledge. That's what teaching is, actually. In fact, teaching is not about about knowledge. It's about ability to communicate knowledge to the person that the person is teaching, so to speak.
On that note, you've spoken before about the importance of teachers, of course, and you've trained over 7,000 teachers over the years in scientific knowledge and methodology. But earlier you also talked about how the role of the teacher might be changing into that of
That's
facilitator.
Right. That's right.
Could you elaborate? So what are you helping teachers with at the moment?
So all the time, in each of our training, we always push for the idea that the teacher will now become the facilitator of learning for the student. In other words, it's empowering learning, so to speak. So the student is now empowered to learn. And that is how it should be, because that's the only way the student can take ownership of his or her knowledge, so to speak. So the teacher facilitates by motivating, by giving good ideas, by saying good things. And I'm sure a lot of us would remember very fondly of teachers who have done this for us before. There's a saying that the subject that you lack the most is usually the subject which you had the best teacher for. It's not actually it may not necessarily be the subject that you're good at or something that you really or so-called naturally good at. It is actually the subject that you have had a good person to facilitate your knowledge. And if you look back, or at least in my case, and I've spoken to a lot of people about this, and when I ask them what was the teaching methodology of this person that they remember, a teacher that they remember fondly, and in almost all the cases, in fact, in my case, based on the persons that I've talked to, and also in my, from my personal experience, are the teachers who are acting as a facilitator. So, I mean, maybe the, your listeners can also remember, try to remember the teacher that you lacked the most, and then try to compare that person's teaching method to the teaching method of a teacher that you may not like, so to speak. Yeah. So we keep pushing the idea of teachers being a facilitator. So it has gained traction. So we have been doing this for 9 years now. So much so that right now, the teachers have got so much experience to share that they are now teaching us. So we're actually learning from them now more than... So last time we used to train them, now we do sharing sessions. Last time we used to do training sessions, now we get the teachers together and we do sharing sessions. Because we noticed that actually the teachers now, by now they're already much better than us in terms of communicating knowledge. Yeah.
What have been some of the key results that you've noticed from all this work? You know, and how do you measure success? Are you looking at... You know, students who are more excited about science, are we still looking at grades? How are we measuring whether this program is successful?
There are many ways. We do surveys, we do all kinds of things. But I'll just say the most important thing to me on how I would measure success is to look at a student and to look at his or her self-confidence. Because at the end of the day, it's all about self-confidence. Because a lot of people say science and math is difficult. When they say, let's say, for example, if I were to say science and math is difficult, but I've already put a barrier on myself. So that means I'm no longer confident. You know, they say, oh, this subject, oh, I'm not confident with this subject. I mean, I'm sure you've heard this term, say, I'm not confident with this subject. But what we're trying to do is, no, you need confidence. If you have confidence, all subjects become easy. So that's how we measure. So we've been measuring quote-unquote confidence. I'll give you a quick anecdotal this thing of confidence. Just so happened that 2 years ago, 2 years ago, the winner of Science Fair, they were invited for an event. And this particular event, the Prime Minister was the main guest of honor. And the person, the winning team was put at the entrance of the hall. So the Prime Minister goes and looks at all the different. And then the last thing that he's going to look at is the Science Fair, the students. You know, these are all standard five students. They are this thing. So I was just observing them. And then as the Prime Minister comes and then he stands in front of these students, the students start asking, okay, thank you, sir, for visiting our science fair, our science experiment. Our science, our objective is, so it's objective, methodology. And after that, in the hall, so the hall, they already saw the Prime Minister is waiting there. So they started announcing, said, okay, mengumumkan ketibaan. And then the guy who's ushering the Prime Minister puts up his hand and said, like, hold on, slow down, telling the MC. So the MC, oh, okay, sorry, the Prime Minister is engaged at the moment. So he continues, the students continue talking. And then the Prime Minister says again, oh, I got to go now, he's got in. And then the student says, no, you have to finish me. Okay, they did not say it in those words, but they said, let me finish, then you go. That's what they were saying. So three times, the guy the MC keeps saying, mengumumkan ketibaan, okay, then he stops. And then again, mengumumkan, three times he does this. Only after the student has finished explaining, saying finally, okay, our conclusion is da-da-da-da-da. Only then he said, thank you very much, sir, for coming to this thing. Only then the Prime Minister could go. So to me, that is an example of confidence. The students do not care that who this person is or whatever. Look, my project is important. My knowledge is important. I have to share it with the person that came to me and I have to finish sharing it. And this we have seen over the years as we walk along these booths of Science Fair. Last time, as you walk along, they used to hide away and said, hey, please don't visit my booth. I don't want to talk about it. Now it's that they will call you. In fact, if there's a five in a team, one person will go and say, come and visit my booth, come and visit my booth, that kind of thing. So it's confidence, I would say. So the confidence have grown a lot. And that's why the students have gone on and won international competitions. It's all to do with confidence. Yeah.
ASTI has also worked on the Young Investors Challenge as well as running creative thinking camps. Could you tell me about both those projects?
So Young Inventors Challenge, so the science fair is for primary schools. So we started a new program called Young Inventors Challenge about three years ago, 2013 actually. So it's for secondary schools, open to all students. Even refugee kids, we get Orang Asli kids to participate and all that. So it's open to everyone, STEAM-based. And the whole idea is to think out of the box. So when you come up with an invention, it's something you have to create something which has not been created before or go along a path which has not trodden before, so to speak. So that requires even more confidence. Because in science fair, you're repeating somebody else's experiment. Here, you're actually doing something totally new. So that's something we started for secondary school students, where we train. This time we don't train just the teachers. We also train. We call them mentors this time. We don't call them teachers. We call them mentors. We train the mentors and the students on how to think inventively, how to think innovatively, how to think out of the box and all that kind of stuff. And then after the training, they get about three months to come up with an invention, after which they come for an event. And then they are judged. But what makes Young Inventors Challenge slightly unique is we are actually judging the inventor, not the invention. So although the invention may be very good, but the inventor did not go through a particular process or wasn't confident, or he took somebody else's idea and he just changed it a little bit, may not get as much a mark as a person that came up with something from scratch, so to speak. So we're actually judging the inventor. So the whole idea is to get students to think inventively. So it's an educational project. It's not an invention project. It's more educational project. So that's the Young Inventors Challenge. And then the Creative Critical Thinking Camp is a three-day camp where we invite students, and we full of activities. So it's all activities related to creative and critical thinking, like to get students to start thinking in a creative and critical manner. Yeah.
You've mentioned in a previous interview that you purposely keep your work low-key for two reasons. What are those reasons?
I'm a shy person,
okay.
Believe it or not. That's one. Number two is it's better to keep yourself low-key because we do not want to be seen as a competitor or someone who's trying to take over somebody else's job. Rocking the boat. We like to see ourselves as someone who complements the work that other people do. So we have kept ourselves low-key for the longest time. But in more recent time, only we decided to come out of our low-keyness, let's say. Yeah.
And have there been others, perhaps from the Indian community, coming forward to assist? Are you hopeful that people will get more involved?
In terms of involvement, we are quite good. We got close to 400 volunteers who work on the particular project, go to schools, motivate the students and all that kind of stuff. So there's 400 of them all across the country. And we've got more than 200 judges. So these are 200 judges who come and judge. They give one full day. These are professionals, people, engineers in Intel, in Petronas and all that. They come and then they become judges for the whole day. They give the whole day. One full weekend they give up for our science fair. So we got about close to 200 judges like that. So in terms of community involvement, we are okay. I wouldn't say we are doing well. Of course, we could do better, but we are okay for now. But in terms of funding, we've been a bit tight. So that is what we are looking on now. In fact, that's one of the reasons why we decided to come out is because of the funding issue. Although we try to keep everything as low as possible, it's still once your project grows to the size that we have. So, like for example, Science Fair, we've got 80,000 participants every year. So to run a project with 80,000 participants is not exactly cheap. No matter how cheap you make it, the price will go up. So in terms of involvement in the long term in resources, funding-wise, we are still not there yet. But in terms of community involvement, professionals coming in and helping us and all that, we are quite well off in that sense. Again, we do not mind more volunteers to come and help us. Because the more volunteers we have, the more things we can do.
How have you been funded? How have you been keeping afloat?
It is a case-by-case, year-by-year challenge. One reason why, when I first came back from UK, I had a full set of hair. Now I'm kind of like bald. Oh, well. But it's very stressful trying to get funding. So every year we go and approach foundations and governments and whatnot. And some years we get money from certain foundations, some years we don't. And then the following year we get, and the following year we don't. So that's that uncertainty is a bit of a stress, so to speak. So that's how it is at the moment. So it's one of the student foundations that come once and then leave. But there has been one or two foundations that have been funding us consistently. One is the Malaysian Community Education Foundation. The other one is a slightly newer foundation called MINADI, who's been more consistent. But what we are hoping for is at least for some of the bigger foundations to kind of adopt the particular project so that we do not need to worry about funding, and we can then develop the project further in terms of knowledge and depth-wise. Yeah.
Moving forward then, how can people get involved in your work, and what do you hope for ASTI and the work that you do?
The first and foremost involvement that you can have is to volunteer with us, to work with the projects, some of the works that we work with. We've got Creative Critical Thinking Camp, we've got Science Fair, and then we've got Young Inventor Challenge. We also got other smaller projects, like we work with media, print media, so to speak, and then we write articles for the print media on science and on technology, on innovation, stuff like that, which gets published now and then. So if we can get writers to help us, then we can talk to more media outlets to publish these articles. Then, of course, in terms of funding, if there's any way of us, we have actually started an endowment fund now. Hopefully, with the endowment fund, we can have with its own group of trustees. Hopefully, with that endowment fund, we can then not worry about funding, especially operations costs. Because we are run. I'm a volunteer, by the way. I don't work. I don't take a salary from this particular project. And most of us, that 400 volunteers that I talked about, we are all volunteers. We only got 3 full-time staffs working on this. So the operational budget is always the biggest issue. So if you could help by helping us with the operational funds and all that, that'd be great. So you can contact us, actually, or go to our website. All the details are there. It's www.asti.org.my.
Yeah. Thank you very much for coming in, Dr. Yunus. I've been speaking with Dr. Muhammad Yunus Muhammad Yassin, President of the Association of Science, Technology and Innovation, or ASTI. Together, we've been discussing the changing attitudes towards science and math in Malaysian Tamil schools and the work that ASTI has been doing. You've been listening today to Live and Learn on The Bigger Picture, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, The Business Station.